and Downs said, if there's an election in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh won 80 to 90% of the vote. So they had to avoid that. You pretend there's a democracy, you call it a democracy. This is an epic battle between democracy and communism. And in fact, in the 50s, that language was often used with the Middle East too, especially after Nasser, right? Even though obviously Nasser, you know, he had connections to the Soviet Union getting aid and so forth. But, you know, inside Egypt, he was, you know, attacking the Egyptian Communist Party, but it didn't matter, right? It's just like today, right?
You're listening to Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
It's interesting along these lines. I found this document some time ago, which I thought was really quite amazing. It was dated May 1st, 1950. It's very early on, right? And it was sent from the Department of State. Dean Acheson was Secretary of State at the time, and it was sent to diplomatic and consular officials. And the title of it was Anti-Americanism is Resurging in the Arab World. And it went on at some length, describing in detail many of the anti-American actions it had seen in Syria and Lebanon. The document could have been written yesterday, changed the date and the names. It was exactly the same. And one part of it, though, which I really kind of, you know, focused in on, it gave a list of the reasons why the Middle East was becoming anti-American. And one of them was, and this is a Department of State quote, one of the reasons was a sincere objection to America's part in Palestine developments. So by 1950, the United States is well aware of what its involvement in the region is doing. And so the blueprint is already in place for this expanded role. And then you see, you know, in rapid fire, you see events like Suez in 1956. In 1953, you saw the overthrow of Mossadegh, and then you have the overthrow of revolution led by Karim Qasim. 1958, there's an intervention in Lebanon to try to actually, at that point, prop up Kamil Kamoun, and so on. So the United States is increasingly involved. And within those areas, you start to see the development of indigenous resistance. In 1960, inside southern Vietnam, the anti-American, let's call them that for a moment, forces established the National Liberation Front for South Vietnam. And then in 1964, the PLO was established. Something interesting, too, is the idea of, for want of a better term, geographical legitimacy. The United States will always say that, and Ken Burns and liberals say this today still, that North Vietnam invaded South Vietnam. The resistance really was in the South. The North clearly had, was run by the Communist Party of Vietnam. Most of the Southern resistance were people who were Southerners. You know, the U.S. would say they were outsiders and they were, you know, trained in the North to go into the South and so forth. The vast majority, almost the entire resistance in Southern Vietnam was Southern. These are people who had fought with the Viet Minh, they'd fought against the French, and they remained there. For the most part, the resistance in Southern Vietnam was indigenous. Right. And we hear this all the time, this trope of outsiders coming in and creating problems with regard to the PLO in Palestine. We know that it's an indigenous movement based on these really longstanding developments. But the same thing happens in Vietnam, too. You would continue to hear this, you know, they invaded us kind of stuff. But the reality is, first, there really weren't two Vietnams. One was just artificially invented. And the reality was that the Vietnamese fighting in the South, trying to get rid of the government, were actually Southerners themselves. And, you know, when I started to understand politics later than the 60s, but not much, two of the people who were often lauded and linked together were Ho Chi Minh and Yasser Arafat, you know, as well as Castro and Che and Nelson Mandela and others. But Ho and Arafat were always lauded on the left as part of the same struggle. And, you know, you don't have to be a communist to understand the importance of those third world revolutions. They gave each other support, but it was also important to have countries like the Soviet Union and China with regard to these smaller places because they had what they saw as some protection. They had a little bit of cover, which I think is one of the biggest differences today because Palestine's isolated in ways that Vietnam never was. Vietnam fought on its own. It had an amazing military. But it also got significant levels of support and aid from countries like the Soviet Union and China, whereas obviously today in Gaza, there's nothing like that, and the other Arab states are not involved in ways really at all, right? But those liberation movements in the 60s were really crucial. Okay, the United States, you know, it always has this rhetoric, we were born of revolution, all that kind of stuff. The United States despised these revolutionary movements. Inside Vietnam, the United States began fighting a massive war. Vietnam is obviously much bigger than Gaza, but neither of these are big, massive, huge countries, right? Inside Vietnam, the United States began to employ massive firepower. Inside the military, there was actually a great deal of resistance to the Vietnam War because, you know, these generals and admirals said, we're preparing to fight against the Soviet Union in Europe. I mean, the idea of using B-52s, which are these massive bombers, they can saturate an area with one flight, one sortie of 1 by 2 square miles. The idea of using B-52s in Vietnam was considered crazy by Air Force generals, yet they did it. The United States established free fire zones, search and destroy missions. They deforested entire areas with herbicides, napalm, Agent Orange, white phosphorus was used broadly. If you were to put together a list of the kinds of things the United States did, it would match with great, you know, synchronicity what's happening today with Israel. The United States in Vietnam, especially in the later years of the war after Nixon took over in 1969, began to attack the North more vigorously, which included bombing schools, civilian centers, hospitals, and so forth. Very similar to today. The biggest difference, though, is the DRV, and as I mentioned before, had the capacity to fight back much more strongly. It had received a great deal of military equipment from the Chinese and the Soviet Union, especially. It had surface-to-air missiles, which it used with great effect. In the famous Christmas bombings of 1972, Nixon claimed that the United States bombed Vietnam so badly they came back and negotiated, right? The reality is actually quite different. The Vietnamese in the Christmas bombings shot down an estimated 34 B-52s. And in my, I forgot to look up, I forgot what they cost each, but it was, the United States took significant losses in Vietnam. One thing I'd be curious, this is what Israel's lost in Palestine, in Gaza today, right? Because we do see those videos, we saw those quite a bit, where Israeli tanks are being blown up and sabotaged. And remember, in both of these places, you have similar wars. You have these kind of guerrilla wars going on, too, these partisans. And so I think that's kind of important to understand, too. So the United States is just destroying Vietnam, right? A small country, which, you know, the world was really aghast at that, but didn't really do much about it. Again, very similar, right? The United States would establish what they call free fire zones, where everybody in the area was considered Viet Cong. The war in large measure was based on, the success was based on body counts. How many of the enemy did you kill? And the old saying was, if it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's a VC. Older people, kids, buffalo, right? So the United States is racking up these huge body counts because it's just destroying everything in sight. The United States displaced villagers. It created a strategic hamlet program in the early 60s where they took people away from the villages where they'd been living. Peoples who had lived there, their ancestral homes, their ancestral graveyards, and so forth, they removed them and put them into these strategic hamlets, which were referred to at the time as concentration camps. So there is a forced dispossession of people in Vietnam, too. So, and the one thing to keep in mind is it's what I'm seeing today is horrific. It's chilling. I haven't seen anything like this really since the Vietnam era. But it's not unique. This is the way empires, and clearly the way the United States does things, right? It included massacres. We've probably all heard of My Lai. My Lai occurred pretty regularly. And more stuff has come out about that now. There was a force called Tiger Battalion that would go around in its area of operations and just kill entire villages. My Lai is the best known. In My Lai, I think 400 people were killed in that particular day. And we're probably familiar with it, where American soldiers just went in and literally, you know, filled ditches up and killed people and raped women. It was horrific, right? In that same region, in March of 1969, the United States killed 10,000 Vietnamese with airplanes, with air power. So we focus on the atrocities, but you know what you see is this entire attack based on these, you know, real violations of war. There were people who were accusing the UN of violations of international law, of war crimes, of atrocities. There were citizens' tribunals led by the famed philosopher Bertrand Russell. American soldiers in a group called the Vietnam Veterans Against the War had winter soldier hearings where they went around the country letting people know what they had witnessed or what they had done in Vietnam. And then you see this, of course, in Israel as well. The United States got closer to Israel after 1967. American aid to Israel was clearly significant from the start, but fairly temperate, relatively. So from the creation of Israel until 1959, like the first decade of its existence, the U.S. sent $650 million to Israel, and only a small percentage of that was considered military aid. In the 1960s, that increased to $834 million, and about 30% was military aid. But by the 1970s, you see this massive growth in it, up to over $16 billion, and over 70% of that is considered military aid, and then it obviously grows from there. So the United States is also making this massive economic, financial commitment to both Israel and Vietnam to try to defeat both the Viet Minh, Viet Cong, National Liberation Front, and the forces of liberation inside Palestine, right? One thing I always point out here, because I think it's important, is that Jimmy Carter had a big role in this too. Carter, you know, did amazing things after he left the White House. I think very admirable. As president, Carter was a friend, a real good friend to Israel. American aid. There are two major spikes in that era. You have aid, which goes up, but in 1973, there's a huge spike, right? Because of the Ramadan-Yom Kippur War. And then in 1979, there's another huge spike because of the Iranian Revolution and the oil embargo. Carter is responsible for that. Carter quadrupled military aid to Israel in 1979. He also fired his representative to the United Nations, Andrew Young, because Young had met against orders with Yasser Arafat and other PLO representatives at the United Nations. So this is also, importantly, a bipartisan movement, right? And I have all kinds of data on American support of Israel. I'm sure you're familiar with it already. I just discovered this recently, so I thought it would be interesting to mention it, because I myself had never even thought to look into this. But there was an intersection. There were some intersections between Vietnam and Israel itself. In 1963, Israel floated the idea of recognizing South Vietnam. South Vietnam, the U.S. had recognized South Vietnam in 1955. Israel suggested to the U.S. as a show of support that it would recognize South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam at the U.N. And the United States said no, because, and this is an important issue at the time, the U.S. was afraid that if Israel was linked to South Vietnam, it would alienate liberal Jewish voters in the United States. And that became really an important issue throughout the duration of the war. This idea that most American Jews were very liberal and many already were starting to question Vietnam. And they obviously weren't going to question Israel, but if Israel were linked to this U.S. war in Vietnam, then that would be problematic. On the other side, the North Vietnamese did recognize the PLO in 1968. So there's already a link. But the one in with Israel and South Vietnam I found really quite interesting. Israel did play a role in the Vietnam War. Not a big one, but it did provide some fairly limited military advisors and training. And a lot of this is symbolic. It's a way of saying to the U.S., you know, we're with you. And it was, I think to some degree, it's a way of saying thank you for what you've given us. But military advisors and training were important, especially in areas of counterinsurgency and special operations, which became a huge industry. And it still is, right? In the 80s, Israel was very active in these areas in Central America, where the United States was trying to overthrow or stop these liberation movements like Guatemala and you know, Salvador and Nicaragua. So Israel had a huge role. They would often set up the internal security apparatuses in these places. Israel provided some munitions and equipment, shared some intelligence, gave them some legitimacy with diplomatic relations. The U.S. rejected Israel recognition of South Vietnam in 1963. However, a couple years later, in 1965, the United States significantly increased its role in Vietnam. It was a massive escalation of the war. War wasn't going well at all. It was never going well. And so in 1965, the United States actually reached out to Levi Ishko, the prime minister, and asked if Israel could take a bigger role in Vietnam. You know, they wanted more assistance. This time it was Israel which was reluctant. By 1965, Israel believed it had gained more international credibility and legitimacy and didn't need that association with the U.S. the way it had before. Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, the president, wrote to Levi Ishko that if Israel supported Saigon, it would give a clear signal to the world of Israel's support for resistance to aggression in Vietnam. But the Israelis at the time didn't do it. They didn't think it was in their best interest. Israel began meeting with Vietnamese officials to discuss what kind of support they might give or what they might need. They did seek, South Vietnam began to seek Israeli recognition in 1965. But this time, in a flip, Levi Ishko said that he couldn't do it because if Israel was going to recognize South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam, then would also have to recognize North Vietnam, which really pissed the United States off. Dean Rusk and others were very angry, essentially, like, after all we've done for you and you can't even do this. The other piece where I saw an intersection occurred in 1969 after Golda Meir became prime minister. In 1969, Richard Nixon gave his famous silent majority speech. He said, yeah, there's people out in the streets opposing the war, but most Americans don't. The silent majority supports us. Golda Meir sent him a note congratulating him, saying, what a great act of courage. Blah, blah, blah. The note was leaked. And inside Israel, it caused a firestorm. There was a kind of a pro-American paper named Mariv, and they attacked Meir for supporting Nixon. So clearly, public opinion in both Israel and among liberal Jews in the United States was anti-Vietnam War. Inside Israel, after Meir's message to Nixon was leaked, a rabbi named Balfour Brickner, gotta love it, you know, your kid Balfour, so it says a lot, right? You know what he's going to do, right? But he was a director of interfaith activities for Reform Judaism, said, Golda Meir has driven a wedge between herself and the liberal intellectual Jews of America, who saw no conflict in supporting Israel's struggle while opposing the unjust, unwise war in Vietnam. He said that Meir reaching out to Nixon would alienate many of Israel's friends and America's academic community. How quaint, they cared about what professors thought back then, because no one's asking me my opinion on anything right now, right? It would alienate liberal Protestants and Catholics and the clergy and among politically active young people with liberal inclination. Both of these countries, then, both of these situations are part of this global anti-colonial movement for national liberation, and they're getting the same response, and that's important. It's just going on all over the place. It's also interesting because one of my side gigs, I call it, is I am often at war with Oliver Stone's people over the Kennedy assassination. The assassination itself, I don't care about, but their basic argument is that Kennedy was a man of peace and he was going to change the world and he was going to get out of the Vietnam War. One of the things they cite is that Kennedy stood up to Israel. I'm still not seeing that. And I actually look at all the documents. I don't like look at vignettes like they do. The United States took basically the same approach to events in Palestine. The PLO was immediately labeled a terrorist organization. Aid increased to governments in that region. As I said, as part of this regional arrangement as well, right? And in both places, you also saw regional wars. Who knows what Gaza will look like going forward, right? But it's really a terrifying thought. Vietnam, again, though, as I point out, was fortunate in that it could get outside support from places like, the Soviet Union and China. The axis of resistance, the so-called active resistance, is very different, right? It does have a level of involvement, you know, in supporting the fights, but nowhere near what countries like, the Soviet Union or China would, right? The United States could go after Laos and Cambodia, but it's not going to go after the Soviet Union and China. And in fact, Nixon creates a detente specifically with the Soviet Union and China. The United States understood Vietnam, Vietnam was a bad idea, and began to look for outlets after Nixon took over, especially Kissinger in 1970, said this is going to be the year of Europe, and we're going to reach out to the Europeans because Vietnam is a bad idea. There's nothing similar to that now, right, where everybody just doubles down on what is already clearly a genocide, right? Another part that's important, but again, plays out differently, is global condemnation. By the later 1960s, the U.S. was really getting an earful from its allies. And I've seen documents on that from the British, from the French and others saying, you're destroying the alliance. You are giving the Soviet Union massive propaganda victories. You're destroying the global economy, which is a real issue with these wars, right? So they're encouraging the United States to get out of Vietnam or to delay it or to de-escalate or whatever. Eventually, the U.S. does. I respect the hell out of the anti-war movement. I would argue the United States finally de-escalates in Vietnam because the global economy requires it. And I've often wondered like how that will play out today because we're obviously in a time of real precarious economic conditions. So far today, those major allies continue to support the United States, places like the UK and Germany. Now, lately, we've seen what I would still call more or less performative changes in that. And I don't know how those are going to play out, but they tend to be, you know, kind of smaller. You see these statements coming out of places like the UK or Italy or Spain. And that, I think, eventually is really going to be crucial. By itself, it's very difficult to defeat the empire, especially an empire like the United States directly in Vietnam, where it's just, you know, the United States dropped 4.6 million tons in a place the size of New Mexico. The United States is subsidizing it, but it has the same effect today. Another thing that I think is important is that we've seen an abandonment of what used to be called soft power. Not that I'm a proponent of soft power, but they don't even try that anymore. They immediately go straight to the most violent responses possible. This is also true of resistance at home. The anti-war movement is now met with violent and immediate resistance. There's no assumption. I mean, Trump does not differentiate between like nonviolent or violent protest or whatever, right? They're all to be met the same way, right? And we obviously saw that. I know we had an event with the directors of the encampments. One thing that struck me, like just to take Colombia for an example, in 1968, when SDS occupied Hamilton Hall because of the Vietnam War, they actually went into the building and took over several offices. They took over the dean's office, the provost's office. It took a week for the Colombia administration to bring in the police. And the removal, you know, they roughed them up and stuff. But now it's immediate. You know, it's immediate and it's rough. The other part, though, that I think is somewhat hopeful is it did take a long time in Vietnam. You know, Noam Chomsky and others have said the first actions they ever saw didn't occur until like around 1965 when the war was well underway. Now it's immediate. It's immediate, right? On campuses, in communities, and elsewhere. So that may be some cause for hope. Let me kind of just, you know, to sum up, I think Gaza is an example of the lessons of Vietnam, but I think a lot of it is that the ruling class has learned those lessons too. And they're doing things differently. They're doing things immediate. They're hitting with a level of force that they hadn't used before. The ideas are the same. The goal is the same, to defeat liberation movements. These movements could be called communists. They could be called terrorists. In Vietnam, the rationale for opposing them was, or opposing anti-war people, was that they were communists or they were communist dupes. Today, calling somebody Hamas fills the same role, right? And 1969, you know, Ho Chi Minh is the new Hitler. They're a bunch of terrorists. Today, it's Hamas, right? It's an old playbook, and they've learned well from it. So I think understanding, I'm not sure how much it helps nowadays, because let's face it, it's a fairly bleak situation. But I think understanding America's long time resistance to movements like this and the lengths to which it will go to defeat these movements, often very violent means, right, is worth knowing. But within that, I do think that there are ways that these people who I really admire the hell out of, right, these groups who are out there. It's interesting not to single out JVP, who I think does great stuff. I don't want to, like, shortchange Palestinians resisting as well. But JVP often reminds me of a very important group in the Vietnam era, VVAW, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, because veterans had a particular kind of credibility and legitimacy. They were in the war. And I think JVP kind of has that too, which is why you see the media pay so much attention to them. It makes it a little bit harder, I think. It wasn't that easy in the 60s to say, oh, those guys are a bunch of communists. They're veterans. They were fighting in Vietnam. And in the same way, it's a little harder, I guess, to say that JVP is anti-Semitic. I want to end with a poem by Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh was a great poet. And I always like this one because it kind of shows the sense of kind of hope that he had. He wrote this when he was under arrest. But as he was in prison, he wrote, "Being chained is a luxury to compete for. The chained have somewhere to sleep. The unchained haven't. The state treats me to its rice. I lodge in its palaces. Its guards take turns escorting me. Really, the honor is too great." Ho wrote that at a very bleak and dark moment in Vietnamese history. He was imprisoned. The Viet Minh were fighting against the French and the Japanese, and then eventually the French again and the Americans. And yet he saw this kind of hope, this sense of light, and it's very hard to find nowadays, right? So I think it's better to end on this note that even in the midst of the Vietnamese Revolution, Ho was in jail. Van Nguyen Giáp was in jail. French authorities killed General Giáp's wife. There were massive, large-scale killings of Viet Minh and Viet Minh supporters, or people who even just like were accused of being Viet Minh, right? Ho still had that idea that he could be whimsical and talk about it and talk about what he called a Vietnam 10 times more beautiful. And I think people today who see, you know, a free Palestine in the future are doing the same thing. And I think that's really critical. So thank you again and all of you. And I really appreciate this.
You were just listening to Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now. He spoke in Washington, D.C. in mid-June 2025. Robert Bezanko is an award-winning scholar and a professor emeritus in history at the University of Houston. He's co-host of the Green and Red podcast. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now, and for Rashid Khalidi's classic book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. With Fairuz singing in Arabic, Sanarji'u Yoman, one day we will return.
Learning the lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for greatest of all time, as in spaghetti sandwiches for dinner. They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh, online at WRCT.org.
Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? And if you did, realized what I had done. I stood alone in the cold gray dawn and knew I'd lost my morning sun. I lost my head and I said some things. Now comes the heartaches that the morning brings. I know I'm wrong, but I couldn't see. I let my world slip away from me. So hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? And if you did, was she crying, crying? Hey, if you happen to see the most beautiful girl that walked out on me, tell her I'm sorry. Tell her I need my baby. Oh, won't you tell her that I love her? If you happen to see the most beautiful girl that walked out on me, tell her.
Listen to the children while they play. Now ain't it kind of funny what the children say? Skip a rope. Daddy hates mommy, mommy hates dad. Last night you should have heard the fight they had. Gave little sister another bad dream. She woke us all up with a terrible scream. Skip a rope. Skip a rope. Oh, listen to the children while they play. Ain't kind of funny what the children say. Skip a rope. Cheat on your taxes, don't be a fool. Now what was that they said about a golden rule? Never mind the rules, just play to win. And hate your neighbor for the shade of his skin. Skip a rope. Skip a rope. Oh, listen to the children while they play. Now ain't it kind of funny what the children say? Skip a rope. Stab them in the back, that's the name of the game. And mommy and daddy are who's to blame? Skip a rope. Skip a rope. Just listen to your children while they play. It's really not very funny what the children say. Skip a rope. Skip a rope.
up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled in my closet, threw my clothes and found my cleanest dirty shirt. Then I washed my face and combed my hair and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day. I'd smoked my mind the night before with cigarettes and songs I'd been picking. But I lit my first and watched a small kid playing with a can that he was kicking. Then I walked across the street and caught the Sunday smell of someone's frying chicken. And Lord, it took me back to something that I lost somewhere, somehow along the way. On a Sunday morning sidewalk, I'm wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. 'Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing short of dying that's half as lonesome as the sound of the sleeping city sidewalk and Sunday morning coming down. In the park I saw a daddy with a laughing little girl that he was swinging. And I stopped beside a Sunday school and listened to the songs they were singing. Then I headed down the street and somewhere far away a lonely bell. And it echoed through the canyons like a disappearing dreams of yesterday. On a Sunday morning sidewalk, I'm wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. 'Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing short of dying that's half as lonesome as the sound of the sleeping city sidewalk and Sunday morning coming down.
The county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I know I need a a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the
sunshine. Wake up, sleepy head. Why'd we move that Bojangle clock so far away from the bed? Just one more minute, that's why we moved it. One more hug or two. Do you love waking up next to me as much as I love waking up next to you? I'll make the bed, I'll fix your lunch and you fix mine. Now tell me the truth, do these old shoes look funny? Honey, it's almost nine. Now you be careful, gotta go. I love you, have a beautiful day, and kiss the happiest girl in the whole USA.
For acoustic music, puzzles, interviews, and live performances weekly, join host Larry Berger for the Saturday Light Brigade to get your weekend off to a good start. That's the Saturday Light Brigade, Saturday mornings, right here on 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Who had a teenage daughter who attended Harper Valley Junior High. said, Mama got a note here from the Harper Valley PTA. Well, the note said, Mrs. Johnson, you're wearing your dress is way too high. It's reported you've been drinking and are running around with men and going wild. And we don't believe you ought to be bringing up your little girl this way. And it was signed by the secretary, Harper Valley PTA. Mrs. Johnson wore her mini skirt into the room. And as she walked up to the blackboard, I can still recall the words she had to say. She said, I'd like to address this meeting of the Harper Valley PTA. Well, there's Bobby Taylor sitting there, and seven times he's asked me for a date. And Mrs. Taylor
go wrong. Well, you thought I'd be waiting up when you came home last night. You'd been out with all the boys and you ended up half tied. But liquor and love, they just don't mix, leave the bottle or me behind.
Pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing. Pappy's corn squeezing.
Shh. White lightning.
Well, the G-men, T-men, revenuers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept on cooking.
Shh. White lightning.
And right away I knew, as my eyes bugged out and my face turned blue. Lightning started flashing, thunder started clashing.
White lightning.
Well, the G-men, T-men, revenueers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept on cooking.
White lightning.
Morning as he hit the ground. Mighty, mighty pleasing, your pappy's corn squeezing.
Whew, white lightning.
The G-men, T-men, revenueers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept on cooking.
Whew, white lightning.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried. One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried, mama tried, mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause mama tried. Dear old daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes, working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried, mama tried, mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause mama tried.
Full of flavor since 1949.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Oh. Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM. Which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured in.
There are many, many ways in which a society is gagged. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra-legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media. Then there is the fourth That is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship.
That's P. Sineth, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features P. Sineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style. India, the world's most populous country, is ruled by Narendra Modi, who is the head of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. He first became prime minister in 2014 and has been re-elected twice since, though in 2024 with much lower margins. Before coming to power in Delhi, he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, where he presided over a major massacre of Muslims. Modi and the BJP promote Hindutva, Hindu majoritarianism. It is laced with Islamophobia. Modi is allied with India's billionaire class, who control the country's major media and function as cheerleaders for a regime that gags democracy, free speech, and dissent. Our guest today is P. Sineth. He's an award-winning journalist who writes about rural India. I cover the people, he says, who live at the bottom end of the spectrum. He's the founding editor of PARI, the People's Archive of Rural
India. You're listening to an Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM over the airways in the city of Pittsburgh, streaming online to the world up on WRCT.org.